All right, for those of you who weren't here last week, I began with a caveat saying that I'm approaching the Bible as an outsider and as a layman, not in any way as a seminarian or a theologian, so that the point of view I'm going to be presenting is not necessarily orthodox, learned, informed, and anything like that. Tonight, following up on the first lecture of the fall and the rejection of Eden, I'd like to be concerned with Abraham and the rejection of civilization. Now remember, last week I was talking about the fall as a movement from unity into consciousness, and that consciousness was of, by definition, dualistic, that we can only become conscious of things by edges. We become conscious of light because of the differences between light and dark, so that there's always a quality of an interface between opposites, differences, to make consciousness possible. A smooth, continuous, undifferentiated sphere is, by definition, either trans-consciousness or subconsciousness, but it's not consciousness. So that what the Bible was presenting was a model for the structure of consciousness dealing with the phenomenology of sex and language, so that the original unity of the androgynous Adam, who is split in half by Yahweh and rotates to become the dualistic set of Adam and Eve, is the first breaking up of the unity. Even before the fall, you have the quality in which sexuality is the performance of duality, the beginning of separation, the first step toward consciousness. And sexuality, of course, contains by its definition its opposite of death, in the sense that all sexual creatures are those creatures that die. All asexual creatures divide ad infinitum like amoebas and don't experience death. So there's a quality of moving into a distinct organism, moving into a sexual life, and then splitting up and becoming conscious, so that sexuality is intimately related to the definition of consciousness. The very splitting up of the garden into two trees is a way of polarizing the sphere and creating a field in which consciousness is going to be polarized around these two trees, the tree of the knowledge of good and evil and the tree of immortality. So that the fall begins to be almost a very necessary phenomena. It's almost built into the very definition of the two trees, built into the unfolding of the two sexes, and built into the very fact that God has to point out the tree, and in pointing it out, saying, do not eat it. He is heightening it in consciousness, raising the contradictions, and creating the possibility of disobeying, so that when you make something conscious and say, don't do that, you're giving energy to its opposite and giving energy to the possibility that, yes, indeed, that is precisely what you're going to do. So the fall, as a rejection of Eden, as a rejection of simplistic unity, should be seen as a rejection of Eden in favor of time. So what is being taken on in the flesh, being taken on in the body, is really the body of time. And so what the movement from the garden to the world is all about is the movement out of eternity into time, out of timelessness, into the whole burden of contradiction, of male and female, of this and that, of love and death. Now the central question that then follows in Genesis is, how is consciousness to be lived in time? If one is in time, then how does one carry that burden? How does one deal with the shock of incarnation? How does one deal with the problem of being a limited being in a world of multiplicity? How can then one add up all these multiple events to achieve some unified explanation? So though we are creatures who are limited in time and know the world through differences and edges and distinctions, we still nevertheless have to add up all the differences into some kind of unity, even though that unity is always hearkening to move back beyond time, back into the garden where we can't go back. There's always a sense that the words come flowing out and the words are incremental and in sequence and in series, but there's always some kind of unifying grammar that gives the words an explanation and makes them understood. So it's the relationship, figure and ground, between language or words and grammar or time and timeless that's part of the curious dialectic by which individuals have to move through the world of opposites, the world, the kind of thin razor's edge between the world of the timeless and the world of limitation, which for all contemplatives is always embodied in the very architecture of our bodies, in the sense that the heart beats boom, boom, and beats out two beats and beats out the nature of contradiction. But the interval between the heartbeats, the interval is a space into the timeless, into eternity, back to innocence or back to a transcendental state of consciousness that is beyond duality. So the problem is that when in time, and when one returns to the beating heart and all the burden of its contradictions and loves and hates, how is one to deal with that? How can one take up the flesh? How can one live with the heart? How can one deal with a world of contradiction? How is consciousness to be lived in time? Since, in a sense, consciousness couldn't really be lived in the garden, because what the garden is saying is to be conscious is not to be in time, but only in time is the moment in the rose garden, according to Eliot's version of these things, T.S. Eliot. So the problem is how to create a form of behavior outside the garden that makes human life possible. What the central drama after the fall, the post-lapsarian drama of Genesis, is all about is the problem of culture. Which kind of culture can hold values against the flow of time? What is a way of experiencing consciousness and extending it through time, through human institutions, that makes values possible, that can still make us conscious of God and of Yahweh and His covenants, even though we have been expelled out from the garden and now exist in a world of contradiction and a world of pain? How can, in a sense, can we keep track of time if we're in the world itself? One way, of course, of keeping track of time is just the flow of the blood or the beat of the heart and the contemplative move between the intervals of the heart. But in social forms, in cultural forms, there are basically two ways to keep track of time. There's the usual way in which historians mark time, and that basically has to do with elites, with writing, with civilization, with cities, with the whole sense that there is class stratification, and through the mystery of writing, some people are keeping the records. And the records are consciousness made incarnate. The records are consciousness made discrete, made formed, made eternal, written on clay tablets to outlast the life of any individual. So history and writing is an attempt to institutionally embody the predicament of time and to create a cultural response to the predicament of time. But there's quite an opposite way, one, of course, much more favored in terms of the system of values that we see expressed in Genesis. And that's not history, but it's mirror opposite myth. If history is elites and writing and civilization and class stratification and a breaking up of the tribe into the illiterate and the literate, myth is oral culture, it's tribal, it's mediated by the human voice, and it's embodied in ritual and dance and song, and it's involved with a simple pastoral society, and it has to do with vast reaches of cosmic time. Myth is a way of compressing enormous stretches of time into a single image or a single story. Myth is a way of thinking big. If the historian is thinking in terms of the discrete problems of how to keep the records of so-and-so begat so-and-so, or so-and-so conquered so-and-so, or so-and-so sold so many jars of olive oil to the trader so-and-so for such a price, everything to do with writing is focused and tiny and discreet. But myth is like stepping back and looking at the whole relationship, that figure against the whole ground of being, and asking enormous questions like, who am I? Where do I come from? Where am I going? What's it all about? What are the basic mysteries of human existence? And the way in which myth sometimes culturally is embodied in literate cultures is through an esoteric calendar, or another way of saying it is the myth of time is involved in a sacred calendar, that how you mark time and how you keep track of the larger reaches of time is the way that one deals with the problem of culture and the problem of how do you hold on to values against the flow of time. That time is trying to scatter everything equitably throughout infinity, and time is trying to wear down the walls, tear everything apart. And so human responses to time are try to resist that flow, to try and, with a tablet or a book, or a stella, or a calendar, or some form to try and mark time in such a way that values are held and they last and survive beyond the death of the patriarch or the death of the visionary. So the calendar is basically an oxymoron. It's a contradictory thing. It's a written form of trying to keep track of a large mythic flow of time. It's culture's later response to try and deal with the contradiction between history and myth, or between civilized values and tribal values. But the calendar basically is older even than its written forms. And so the calendar is goes all the way back to the seasonal round before people settled into one place. And it follows the idea of the great round in the sky, whether it's the astrological cycle or it's the precession of the precession of the equinox and the 24,000-year cycle, or it's smaller seasons, or it's just a seasonal round within a year in which, say, Abraham would move out of Ur and up to Haran, and then down from Haran into Egypt, and then back up again in a kind of trading circle in which he would move through the Near East, and at the appropriate time of year, he would be involved in the appropriate economic activity. And he would make his way slowly at a gentle rate of leading his household and his sheep along through that kind of space. So that in just living the season around in a nomadic life, you're living out a calendar. But even larger than the year is the notion of to everything there is a season. And one of the esoteric notions about the season of time is that there is a year that's larger than the ordinary year. If there's a seasonal round within a single 365-day cycle, for the esoteric calendar, there's a 2,000-year cycle, a magnus annus, a great year. And this great year pulses and goes in a kind of rhythm, in at least the Egyptian vision of it, that starts with four seasons: the age of gods, which begins the culture, annunciation of myth; the age of heroes, the kind of military aristocratic class that takes over from the sacred founders; the age of men, a commercial age in which the militarist and aristocratic class fades into the background and a commercial capitalistic trading class takes over; and then finally the age of chaos in which the culture falls apart. So for the esoteric calendar, there have always been these four seasons. Now, from the horizon of Abraham, the previous year, the previous magnus annus, was a 2,000-year cycle that began the Sumerian civilizations, the period of 4,000 BC to 2,000 BC. And this was the period, basically, of the rise of cities, the Sumerian cities of the plains of Shinar, cities of Eresh. Now, according to their myth, these cities were not founded by human beings. They were founded by gods. And so kingship descended out of the sky, and the cities were founded by gods. And so there was the whole sense that the culture began with an annunciation of myth, an annunciation of miracle, in Yeats's phrase, and out of that was created a cultural form that was an attempt to hold values against the flow of time. But once this starts, then, that form, that cultural vision, has to now enter the cycle of the 2,000-year, and slowly, as you move through that cycle, it loses energy, it loses vision, it loses the values it had, so that there's almost a kind of half-life, that you start out with the age of gods, in the age of heroes you have half of the original cosmic vision. When you move from the age of heroes, you have half of that again in the age of men, and finally in the age of chaos, you have that again, and you finally dwindle down to nothing. So in the Sumerian magnus annus, you have the early period and then of the age of gods, and then you move to the period of heroes, where you move away from theocracy and you get the progression of kings and you get the dynasties and you get the conquering armies and you get the whole Sargon of a god effect. That begins to just go from the age of just king following king following king until finally you end up with just a commercial and trading class, and you get just ordinary men following ordinary men, and the whole thing begins to move to a loss of vision, a loss of the cultural integrity, a loss of the basic message. Remember last week I talked about this aspect of a message coming through time in this resisting medium, picking up noise and distortion and coming out the other end as the signal. So if you see this kind of mythic annunciation at the beginning of a magnus annus, what finally comes out at the other end of the 2,000-year cycle when the civilization is exhausting itself is very little of its cultural integrity. And yet there's a strange aspect to the end of a cultural vision, the age of chaos, that as it's beginning to fall apart and go into chaos, it has a kind of intensification in miniature in which the original values are sort of played out, and the whole thing goes into what I've called in other contexts sunset effect. I noticed it the other night in this room when that light bulb burned out. Before it burned out, it went into a kind of lightning flash and then went into darkness. So there's a way in which, whether we're dealing with stars or we're dealing with light bulbs or sunset in a single day, that there's an intensification to something as it's vanishing. Now, this kind of sunset effect is what, of Sumerian culture, is what you see in the historical time of Abraham and is the historical background to Abraham. Because what you have in the third dynasty of Ur is a highly aristocratic, courtly society enormously civilized, enormously sophisticated, that in the sort of glowing embers of what's left of Sumerian civilization is meditating on the whole prospect in writing what really is incredibly great art. One of the court poets created the Gilgamesh epic. And you can see this whole meditation on death and the loss of the death of the spirit of the forest and the improbability of mankind dealing with the problem of death. This whole meditation is very much the vision of an artist in a court of aristocrats seeing his civilization moving beyond its time and knows that it's about to perish. So that the third dynasty of Ur is highly civilized, highly literary, but in that kind of ripeness that's so close to rottenness. It's also the third dynasty of Ur is what Sir Leonard Woolley excavated when he found the death pits of Ur, that there was gold and chariots and harps and all kinds of extremely costly luxury goods. But there was also the death of all the servants, that these goods were buried with a ritual immolation of about 70 people. So the death pits of Ur are all sort of the background. Now, in the Old Testament, it's called Ur of the Chaldees, but that's an anachronism, just like the camels they talk about are an anachronism. And the actual Ur that's being considered is really closer to the third dynasty of Ur. Now, the period of brilliance for the third dynasty of Ur is very short-lived. And then the Elamites come in, the wild sort of tribesmen from the west, and great Ur is given over to the wind. And so you get the kind of beautiful but very concretely tragic poem about lamentation over the destruction of Ur, where they talk about the corpses melting in the sun like butter. And so that the poem is extremely graphic and intense about the whole sense that here is Ur, the greatest of all cities, and now it's given over to the wind, and now the kind of spirit of Lilith just howls in the ruins and it's utterly, utterly dead. So that presumably before this happens in the chronology, Abraham is told, leave the city, go out from the city and go into the land that I will show you. And so he goes from Ur and goes over to the west into Haran. And there he meets with his people that have been circulating as some sort of traders for some time and begins his life. Now whether or not he leaves after the destruction of Ur or before the destruction of Ur is hard to say, but it is still somehow clear that the historical backdrop for Abraham is around 1950 BC and is dealing with the culture of a highly civilized society, so that Abraham is not so much to be seen as a simple nomad or a wild tribesman, but as an individual who is consciously choosing to reject civilization and is being told to go out from it, that no matter how civilized and how advanced and how glorious it may seem, that there's an inner rot to it and its time has come and it isn't very long before the whole thing is going to go under. Now what you have in the consciousness of this historical backdrop is really consummately expressed in the Gilgamesh epic, because the poem begins with a celebration of the city. So it's quintessentially the mirror opposite of the Old Testament. If the Old Testament is celebrating the pastoral vision against the city, the Gilgamesh epic begins with a prologue praising the city. See that wall. The wall is made out of burnt brick. Is it not good? So there's an admiration for the works of man, the artifacts, that try to raise up against the flow of time and maintain the integrity of the human community against the forces of erosion and the second law of thermodynamics and all the forces that are trying to tear order into disorder. So Gilgamesh himself is the kind of great king who embodies the urban values, but when he confronts himself and the problem that he cannot control death, he's forced to deal with all kinds of contradictions, and the limitations of culture are really played out in the poem. First he goes with his friend Enkidu to try and accomplish something great, to make a name that will last through all time. And here again you get this idea that culture is an attempt to hold values against the flow of time. So he says, let us make a name, let us go kill the spirit of the forest. And when they kill the spirit of the forest, and there's this memory of urban man slaying the whole spirit of the forest, the devas of nature, slaying the old traditional animism, and moving into a secular world of engineering and brick building and the whole kind of industrial mentality. When they slay the spirit of the forest, then they become obsessed with the problem of death. Their inability to deal with the kind of circles of nature, the homeostatic mechanism whereby death is part of nature and the spirit of the forest deals with life and death in leaves and soil and trees. When they try to cut that and create a straight line, these walls that go up and don't return to nature, then they become cut off from nature, obsessed by the problem of death, and totally alienated. So the poem is very much the poem of a city man, a poem, really, you can see the roots of the ecological crisis all the way back. So the walls rise up and they obscure, in their kind of human endeavor, the landscape. They cut off the forest from the city, they cut off nature from culture, and they cut off the stars from the horizon. So now the towers and battlements rise up and obscure the stars, and the whole larger mythopoeic horizon of time is lost. So that the intensive secularization of the city is one that really equals a loss of information through time. You begin with myth and the sacred, and as you move and become more and more secular and more commercial and more businesslike, you keep losing information until finally your horizons have really shriveled. And this is really somewhat of the world of the third dynasty of Ur. It's not the grand mythopoeic vision of the annunciation of the cities by the gods of Sumer of 4000 BC. Now, in this condition, Gilgamesh, when he's obsessed by death, goes off on his wandering and tries to find out what the world is all about and tries to resolve the problem of death and the problem of culture. And to do this, he has to leave the city. And he goes into a landscape that's before the flood and moves out of history into myth and moves into the world of the deluge and the fact that there were cities even before the deluge. And he goes and finds the man who is not in time but is out of time, the man, the wise old man of the mountains, Utnapishtim. And Utnapishtim is almost, again, a mirror opposite, since myth deals with nothing in a sense as articulately as the tension of opposites. Utnapishtim is the mirror opposite of Gilgamesh. He is a humble, ordinary man, not the great hero. He was chosen by the gods for no particular reason. He survived not because of any particular cunning or any particular strength. But somehow or other, he has a knowledge from before the flood. And he is a man who is totally simple. He's something like a yogi, and the great hero who has conquered every beast and slain every dragon and slain the spirit of the forest comes to him, and Utnapishtim says, sit there and don't go to sleep. Try and slay your mind. And immediately he falls asleep. So the great hero, when he finally has to confront the nature of consciousness, can't deal with the simple thing of just watching the mind and not falling asleep, watching the mind fall asleep. What Utnapishtim is trying to teach him, in a sense, is called the yoga nidra, the yoga of sleep. And the great hero, who's the great extrovert and can handle everything, can't do with that simple thing, and he falls asleep instantly. And then, out of compassion, he gives him another chance to gain the herb at the base of the well, and he takes the long voyage down to rescue the herb and bring it back to give him immortality. But the serpent comes and takes it away and steals immortality from him. So he has to go back to Ur utterly without triumph, utterly vanquished, utterly without glory, and can just only return to where he started and saying, look at the walls, are they not fine? Are they not beautifully made out of burnt brick? And so for a man like Gilgamesh, there's no possible way that he can resolve all the values of eternity into a temporal form. Utnapishtim, like the wise old man of the mountains, is a sage and is a figure of authority, is a kind of yogi, but he is not a figure of power. So the poem is talking about the relationships between authority and power. Authority is registered in myth and these vast reaches of time. Power is one particular crystallization of authority in institutional form, of trying to lock values into time and saying, this is the way things work. This is a city. This is the way cities relate to nature. This is the way cities relate to armies, or this is the way cities relate to commerce. And the whole attempt to create that intensifies it so much in such a rigidity that it creates its opposite energy, death. And so the whole thing begins to be obsessed with death. And the great city itself, the consummate expression of everything that had been most advanced at that time, is laid open to its opposite, to barbarians, and it's utterly destroyed. So the nomadic vision is, if you put your faith in cities, you're putting your faith in something that's shallow and temporary and cut off and uprooted and has no ultimate value. That if you're trying to deal with the problem of culture, of how to hold values in time, to how to maintain consciousness in time, cities are the wrong strategy. Cities are a mistake. And so the basic aspect that you get in the Old Testament is the rejection of urbanization. Go, leave Ur and go into the land that I will show thee. So what you have, in a sense, is primitivism, but a primitivism that in another dimension is the turn on the spiral that's at a higher moral level than civilization. So you have, in a sense, Abraham, like Moses, is a nativistic leader. He is not a native. He's not a Slav himself. He has very much seen the ways of the overlords and knows the ways of civilization and very consciously rejects it to go back to the traditional nomadic people and affirm the ways of the past. Now, this is often a pattern for prophetic figures. It's very much like Jomo Kenyatta going back to Africa. It's very much like Gandhi being photographed in top hat and tails in Oxford looking like a dandy and realizing that the English had him and tearing it off and putting the loincloth on and going back to India. Gandhi knew what it, in a British society was like. He had seen the best of it. He had been at Oxford. He had tried to be the dandy. So that what you have, whether it's Malcolm X or Jomo Kenyatta or Patrick Pearce, or Moses himself, who knew the best of Egyptian society and turns his back on it, is a process of cultural change where a revitalization movement is instigated by one who has learned the ways of the civilized overlords and uses them against them and goes back to the primitive and affirms that somehow or other redemption is only through the primitive and the traditional nomadic way of life, the seasonal round rather than the straight line of progress, is the only holy way to live. So I think it's very important because it's more often than not, this pattern is very much emphasized with Moses, but I think it's very important to see it even as far back with Abraham. So in this primitivism of a turn on the spiral, we have, in a sense, a return to the age of gods. Now there is an enunciation of a new myth, a new sense of the sacred, and the beginning of a whole new Magnus Onus. So Abraham is, in a sense, the initiator of the new age that will be 2000 BC to the year 1. In a sense, the whole Judeo Magnus Onus leading to the Christian Magnus Onus. So he chooses the primitive, and he's affirming, in a sense, redemption only through the primitive. Now, in the age of chaos, which is paradoxically the age of highest civilization and progress, so from the mythic point of view, progress is depravity and decadence. From the civilized point of view, the age of chaos is the age of consummate progress and achievement. So these things are exactly, again, opposites and mirror reflections of one another. In the age of chaos, the horizon basically shrinks into now, and you have very much secular concerns for wealth and power, and the individual is only concerned with his life cycle and his lifetime. He's cut off from the idea of death. He's cut off from the idea of generations and tribal man's horizon. He's also cut off from nature, and he's locked into the alleys of Ur, and Ur is a city much like any city, New York or Rome or London. And the whole tunnel vision begins to be concerned with me and mine and the world of the ego. The opposite of that, outside the walls of Great Ur, of course, is the desert horizon. And there you can see the stars and the forgotten past, and then you begin to hear the old legends and begin to discover that the old legends are, in a sense, the detritus of real history. So what you get when you move out of the city is history as a pastoral vision. It's a kind of inversion of the elitist system of values in the city, where the top now becomes the bottom, and the bottom becomes the top. In the world of the cities, they write history, and they say, we're what it's all about, this is the way the world began, and they create a structure of time, a skewed sample of events, that is basically a distortion, and it's a rationalization for their own power. The British in the 19th century said that the Irish had no culture until it was brought in by the Norman conquest, and they wrote in, say, David Hume's history, a whole vision that was basically a rationalization of the British Empire. It had nothing to do with real Irish history. The Irish nativistic leaders had to go out of London and Oxford and Cambridge and back into the midst of the dim Irish past and recreate a whole other vision of time that had with it prophetic implications and revolutionary implications. So that any revolutionary change involves this phenomenon of inversion of the elite systems of values where what is top becomes bottom and what's bottom is becomes top. It's like taking reality and turning it inside out. History is myth. It's in the sense that we use myth to mean bogus or phony or a child's fairy tale. So the kind of thing they write about reality in Ur or in New York or London is just a bogus story told to rationalize the elites in power. When you leave the city and you go into the prophetic landscape of the desert and hear the old oral legends, or leave as Gilgamesh does and goes back through the tunnels to Utnapishtim, then he hears a larger history and he hears the oral legends of the flood, and he discovers that all these child's fairy tales about floods and things like that are actually the detritus of real history. So the inversion is history is myth, and real myth with a capital M is history. Now, in this pastoral vision of Abraham leaving the death pits of Ur and decadence and the acquisitive, accumulative society and going out into the desert, the landscape he moves into in terms of myth and oral legend is, of course, the world of the creation and the world of the fall that I discussed last week. But it's also, in a sense, in the post-lapsarian world, it's a world that is dealing with the whole problem of the relationship between city dwellers and pastoral nomads. And so after the fall, as they move out into the garden, then the behavior of mankind tends to split and people go in different paths. The basic duality, these opposites again that we see, we go from the androgynous to the Adam and Eve, and then we go out of the garden and we go into Cain and Abel. And Cain and Abel, very much like the old Sumerian poem where Inanna chooses the shepherd and rejects the farmer, deals with this problem that Cain is a farmer. And somehow or other, that's suspicious, because farming means settled life. Later on, after slaying Abel, he founds a city, a very suspicious kind of thing to do. And so it's very clear that cities come from the murderer, that cities come from the man who slays his own kin, that city dwellers do not understand tribal values. They don't understand that the human community should be built along bloodlines, not according to specialization, that you live next to another person anonymously because you're a scribe and he's an oil merchant, and that this is the way you structure society. So the cities are founded by Cain, and in describing it and setting up in this way, they're expressing their inherent suspicion of all urban life. Abel, of course, is a pastoralist. He's a shepherd. And so that his offerings are found pleasing to the Lord. The son of Cain, Tubal Cain, is a master of the arts of metalworking. And in many cultures around the world, metalworking is considered highly suspicious, because the craft specialist, the smith, wandered around from village to village, something like a tinker, offering his wares, and he didn't belong to any particular kinship structure. He was a specialist. He had a particular trade to sell, much as, say, professors now travel around from city to city, and they have a specialty to sell, but they don't belong to any particular community. They have no roots in any particular place. So for the village point of view, the specialist is a very suspicious individual. In Greek myth, when Uranus is castrated, he's castrated with a sickle. And there's this whole sense of metal is evil, and metal is an instrument of patricide. Metal is suspicious. So Tubal Cain is the master of the arts of metalworking and master of arts that are cursed. So the coming out of this whole lineage is specialization and the founding of cities. Ham, the cursed son of Noah, is the patriarch of the evil cities of Canaan, as well as being the patriarch of Punt and Cush. Nimrod, the grandson of Ham, builds the cities of Sumer, Erech, as well as Sodom and Gomorrah. So again, you get the sense of the evil cities flowing out of this left-handed lineage. Now, in the movement of this time, as you go from the fall and you get the settling up of these cities, you begin to get evil spreading over the land and the population increasing, and you get decadence. This is very clear in the Sumerian and Babylonian poems on the flood, where they say, the noise of mankind teemed around the worlds, and the gods became offended of the noise of man and wanted to wipe it out and to return to a purity of silence. So you have this whole sense that you begin in myth and great beings who are larger than life. And in Hamlet's Mill by Herta von Däniken, she talks about the way that the whole planet is grinding time with the precession of the equinox, and the kernels are very large at the beginning of the Age of Gods, and so Abraham is larger than life. And as it keeps grinding through the Magnus Annus, the kernels get finer and finer and finer, so that at the end of a cycle, we are sort of petty little men, and no one soul could possibly incarnate one being. So it begins to be a sense of a loss of information, a loss of vision, and you get a multiplication of people around the world, and the population goes up, and noise goes up, so the whole thing becomes chaos, so that the gods decide to wipe it out. Now, in other versions of this myth, the decadence is involved again with sexuality. In the Book of Enoch, which comes from around the first century, which deals with a lot of ancient Midrashic material. They talk about the world before the flood and how the angels, the sons of God, become very attracted to the daughters of men. That which is just very briefly mentioned in Genesis is filled out in great detail in the book of Enoch. And the images, again, are very graphic, that the angels become so attracted that they let down their genitals like stallions and project sexual organs so that they can have intercourse with the daughters of men, and they create a race of giants and monsters. And there's a whole sense that, once again, sexuality is creating problems, and sexuality is the prelude to another fall. So that the world before the flood is very much a recapitulation of the first fall, and once again, it's coded so in the myth that sexuality is what it's all about. So out of this kind of miscegenation between the sons of God and the daughters of men comes the desire to purify the world of sin. And in Enoch, it's very clear that there are cities and that there's human sacrifice and they're eating meat and that everything is really decadent and foul. And so it has to be wiped out. So it's very much a kind of wiping out of Atlantis and a moving away of high civilization. So the world had started simple, and then it moved into civilization, and so it has to be purified and destroyed. So the flood comes, and civilization and the cities are wiped out. Then in the other aspects of this kind of history as myth, as we move forward, we have in the post-Lapsarian world and the post-Noah world, the Tower of Babel. Now, it's really very interesting to look in terms of the language described in Genesis, because it's very clear that what is being rejected again is the whole notion of class stratification and labor and civilization and elites. And the Lord said, "Behold, the people is one, and they have all one language. And this they begin to do, and now nothing will be restrained from them, which they have imagined to do. Go to, let us go down, and therefore confound their language, that they may not understand one another's speech. So the Lord scattered them abroad from thence upon the face of all the earth, and they left off to build the city." So what you have in the whole myth, in a sense, is that the city is class stratification. Go to, let us build a tower and a city. So it means that there has to be specialist division of labor, a whole concatenation of things quite different from the tribal values, bringing things together in an economic surplus so that these great projects can be possible. And it has to be a violation of everything that is simple and eternal and enduring. And so it becomes an act of hubris, and therefore the Lord scatters the tower. So the tower is very much, again, a celebration of order as opposed to natural systems. And therefore it's very much like the celebration of order in the opening of Gilgamesh. Now the irony in the story of the Tower of Babel is that language, we knew from the Midrash, is what makes man man. Remember the conflict and contest between Adam and Samael, and it was Adam who won through language. So now, somehow or other, man's unique excellence is becoming his tragic flaw. And so the negative gift of tongues, the inversion or mirror opposite of the gift of tongues that's being given here, is to scatter the men across the world and to make their languages confounded. So again, the whole sense is as they move towards cities, it's a mistake and it's disrupted. And then finally, moving forward chronologically, we come to the time of Abraham and his movement out of Ur. Now what you have with Abraham is an archetypal pattern, the flight from decadence and the destruction of the city by the primitives. So whether you've got the Elamites destroying Ur, you've got the Goths destroying Rome, or you've got the Chichimecs from northern Mexico coming down and destroying the Teotihuacanos, you have a basic historical archetypal pattern that the cities achieve an intensification of order and form and greatness, and then they're wiped out by the primitives around them. There's something about the city that attracts its opposite. And the more civilized it becomes, the more prone to primitive savagery it is. So what you have then in these patterns is that the fall is echoing throughout all the historical falls, whether it's Ur, or it's the Tower of Babel, or it's the world before the flood, or the world of the garden. There's the first fall, and then a kind of domino effect through time of each fall recapitulating the other. And then the next fall, that is very much part of the same pattern, is the destruction of Sodom and Gomorrah. Now the funny thing about Sodom and Gomorrah is that when Lot is trying to flee. He's a very kind of thick-headed guy, and they keep saying, look, we're going to wipe the place out. Will you please get out? And he's trying to argue with them all the time, and go into the hills, save yourself alive, get out, you know, and please. And he keeps chattering and chattering and chattering and saying, as he's walking up the hills with the angel, and he's come, hey, there's a little city. I can't go to the hills. I won't be able to survive. That's just a little city. Can I have just a little city? It can't be too harmful. Just this tiny little city. And the language itself is just incredible. Behold, now this city is near to flee unto, and this is a little one. Oh, let me escape thither. Is it not a little one? And may my soul shall live. So he says, all right, for you, you know, I'll let you stay in this little city. It's not too big, it's not too evil, but will you hurry up, because I can't do anything until you're safe. And so finally he goes into the little city, and then boom, they destroy the cities of the plain. And eventually Lot has to end up in the hills anyway, because the little city itself is unsafe. So the whole notion in Genesis is that even a little city is suspicious, because basically a small town runs on all the values of a large town, and cities are basically a mistake. Now what you have in this whole relationship between life and the rising up of cities and the fall of cities is an archetypal pattern of decay and regeneration. Whether it's the death of stars that explode and scatter their atomic material in space, and create the exact conditions necessary for the evolution of new solar systems and new life on planets, or whether you have the death of cities and civilizations scattering their energy out, so you can see almost Ur exploding, and Abraham is kind of the early phase of the explosion of Ur outward, casting him into Haran. You have a basic pattern, and that is the pattern that what happens in destruction is that a fertile decay creates a soil, and that this soil is the absolutely necessary medium for the enunciation of the new myth, and that somehow the new age of gods that begins the cycle is intimately linked to the age of chaos, and that you can't have the enunciation of the new myth without the proper disintegration of the old. So somehow or other, Ur is very necessary for what Abraham is to become, because Abraham is not a slob. Abraham is a creation of Ur. And so whatever vision is going to come in the patriarchal era is going to somehow carry what had been in Ur, but in its wrong form. In the same sense that when a star dies, we ourselves carry the matter of those dead stars in our bodies. So there's a way in which there is continuation, but it's continuation through death rather than linear continuation through institutional life. The institutions must die. Now in the new myth, you get basically the new age of gods, and what that means is reconsecration, the new enunciation of a whole cosmic explanation, a new story of who are we, where do we come from, where are we going, what is it all about, and what cultural vehicle can I use to hold values against the flow of time. Now, the new enunciation with Abraham comes, in a sense, from Melchizedek. And that's why I put the sculpture from the Cathedral of Chartres of Melchizedek that Chris gave me for Christmas last year in front. And if you afterward look at his eyes, you will see very much that the initiates of the school, mystical esoteric school at Chartres, very much understood what Melchizedek was all about, because the eyes of this statue are incredible. And Melchizedek, king of Salem, brought forth bread and wine, and he was the priest of the Most High God, and he blessed him and said, blessed be Abraham of the Most High God, possessor of heaven and earth, and blessed be the Most High God, which has delivered thine enemies into thy hand. And then Abraham says, and he gave him tithes of everything he had taken. So there was a war in which Lot had been kidnapped by the Elamite tribes and taken off, and Abraham goes and gets his retainers, about 320 men, and rescues Lot and brings him back and defeats the imperial forces. And after that rescue and the whole new situation is about to begin, then Melchizedek comes out, who is a priest of Salem, which is supposed to be, in some of the Gnostic and Christian texts, Jerusalem. And he comes out and he brings the chalice holding the wine and the bread. And he performs basically a kind of Eucharistic sacrament and creates a consecration and enunciation of a new myth and starting up a whole new religion. So he comes out, in essence, with the Grail. After Melchizedek consecrates them, and after Abraham gives a tithe of a tenth of everything he's taken in the conquest, then Yahweh appears to him and has the first covenant. So Melchizedek, in a sense, is very much part of the new age of gods and is the being who enunciates what the whole new age is going to be about. Now, in the way that time and myth patterns work, he both is looking back to the past and looking to the future. And the way that the Mexican calendar works is that when one Quetzalcoatl, the avatar, comes in, he also reflects the Quetzalcoatl who came before and the Quetzalcoatl who will come in the future. And so there's a rotation of this calendar where the future and the past always rotate in through the present, and the present is informed and impregnated and given meaning to by the dimension of past and the dimension of future. So he's coming from Jerusalem and looking forward to what will be the consecration of the next Magasanas, and he's coming from an unknown past and summing up everything from before. So the fascination that Melchizedek has had throughout all history is he is without father or descendants. He is totally outside of time. He is the first priest mentioned in the Old Testament, and so he begins to be the whole archetype of the priest whose order is not institutional. So Melchizedek is very much a being like Utnapishtim who is outside of time, intersects with time to create this kind of annunciation, and then disappears. So he is always seen sometimes as an angel or a superhuman or extraterrestrial order of Melchizedek or whatever. Now, even into the Sufis, there was an emphasis on the powers and mystery of Melchizedek, and he was seen as a member of a kind of order that has nothing to do with the temple, the city, or institutions. This is reading from Henri Corbin's Creative Imagination in the Sufism of Ibn Arabi. In addition, there are all the invisible, inaudible factors, all that which rests on no other proof than personal testimony to the existence of the subtle world. There are, for example, the visitations of persons belonging to the esoteric, invisible hierarchies, to the confraternities of spiritual beings who form a bond between our world, or rather between each existence and other universes. They dominate the parallelism of the cosmic hierarchies in Ismailism, and live on in the Shaikhism of our time. In these homilies of Shiism shows its power to encompass the secret meaning of all revelations. In one of them, the Imam utters the names under which he had been successfully known by all nations, those who would have a revealed book and those who have none. Speaking to the Christians, he says, "I am he whose name in the gospel is Elijah." Here Shiism, in the person of Imam, proclaims itself to be the witness to the transfiguration, the metamorphosis, Moses meeting with Elijah Kadir as his initiand in the 18th surah has as its counterpart the colloquy between Moses and Elijah, that is, the Imam on Mount Tabor. This typology is extremely eloquent as to the intentions of the Shiite mind. It would be a simple matter to compile testimonies to showing how Shiite thinking, if we hearken to it, upsets our current ideas on the relations between Christianity and Islam. Ismailian esotericism has another homily in which the Imam proclaims, "I am the Christ who cures the blind and the lepers," which means the second Christ we read in a gloss, "I am he and he is I." And if elsewhere the Imam is designated as Melchizedek, we easily discern the connection between this imamology and the Christology of the Melchizedek Christians who saw in this supernatural person the true Son of God and the Holy Spirit. So in ordinary Orthodox Judaism and Christianity, Melchizedek just comes in on the scene and it's just about three or four lines and he's gone. In the whole esoteric tradition of the Gnostics, in the Pistis Sophia and in the Essene Melchizedek documents, he takes on a whole enormous life as the avatar, as the Christ figure, and as the whole annunciator of what is going to be the sacred pattern of the whole Magasanas of the Judeo-Christian civilization. So what Melchizedek is holding in his hand is the Grail. And the Grail is basically the vessel of human evolution. So whether it's the Grail of Jesus or Joseph of Arimathea or Arthur, you're dealing with a pattern where the vessel of human evolution is the means by which values are held against the flow of time. And in this vision of the order of Melchizedek, the vessel is not specifically a culture or an institution or a temple, because temples are in cities, and the order of Melchizedek is not of cities. This is a priesthood that does not derive from man and human institutions. It's outside of time. The human vessel is basically the planet, and the planet is created as the means by which life can evolve and which consciousness can be elevated. So whether you're dealing with the problem of how can Arthur create a social vehicle to hold values against the flow of time, or whether you're dealing with kind of group meditation at Lindisfarne, you're dealing with the whole meditation upon the idea of the vessel and the esoteric dimensions of the Grail. But from this esoteric and Gnostic point of view, the Grail has to be seen in enormous scope, not simply an institution or a temple, but the whole planet itself. So the consecration with Melchizedek is, in a sense, preparing Abraham for the covenant with Yahweh. And so it's very fascinating in Genesis how we go from this very mystical thing that's going to be obsess the imaginations of Gnostics for centuries to something very concrete and very Semitic, in the sense that when Yahweh comes and says, I'm going to make your kin numberless as the stars or the sands in the desert, and Abraham replies saying, how will I know this, Lord? And he begins to sort of strike up a bargain. And he says, go and get me, you know, a lamb and an animal and a goat and cut them in half. And so in the old form, what is going on is to cut a covenant, is to take an animal and cut it in half and walk between it and say, let this be done to me if I don't observe this covenant. So the whole notion of covenant is a contract. And Abraham is a kind of crafty trader, a kind of rug merchant nomad who's able to get Yahweh and make him sign the dotted line. So we go from this enormously mystical and mysterious Melchizedek who moves in on the scene of history and then flees to something that's very concrete and very specific. And in this age of gods, there is a way in which the divine is prosaic. In the age of chaos, you have the divorce between the sacred and profane, because everything is so profane, you have to transcend to get the cosmic or the sacred. But in the age of gods, everything is sacred, and so God can sign a covenant, and Abraham can be a crafty rug dealer, and everything can be very concrete, and there isn't the sense of profanation. God is visible to Abraham, and so he can have a gentlemanly conversation with him. Moses can't have the same kind of relationship. Not even Joseph can have the same relationship. So there's a way in which God is concrete and specific and ordinary. And from the most mystical point of view, God is the most ordinary thing in the universe, because God is the universe, and what could be more ordinary than what is? So what we have is another set of patterns. If myth holds information against the flow of time, then patterns are really the crystals by which myth holds that information into form. So when you're looking at all these patterns of time, you're looking at a kind of crystalline structure. Remember that Levi-Strauss, in the quote I was talking about last week, talks about myths as having the structure of crystals. So that the necessity of these recapitulating patterns is part of a crystallization of form by which something is so tight and so intense that it's a safe vessel for values against the distortions of time or the loss of information, so that it's possible to create a myth where the people who recite the stories themselves don't even understand its esoteric significance. Witness the whole aspect of Melchizedek. So when you have these patterns like Abraham and Pharaoh, you have a pattern which is the precursor of Joseph and Pharaoh and Moses and Pharaoh. You have Abraham and Sarah as sister-wife, which is echoed again in Isaac and Rebekah as sister-wife. You have Sarah, who's barren until late, which moves forward to Rachel, who is barren until late. Hannah, the mother of Samuel, is barren until late. And then Elizabeth, the mother of John the Baptist, is barren until late. So you have the whole notion that the mother of the prophet somehow has to violate normalcy. And in fact, in terms of genetics, they say that women who have babies in advanced age tend to give a higher proportion of geniuses and idiots. So that there is something in this folk wisdom that the unusual being comes out of unusual circumstances. Other patterns are like Jacob at the well looking for a wife, which recalls Isaac's servant looking for Rebekah. Moses is also at the well with Zipporah, the daughters of Jethro, and he marries the daughters of one of the daughters of Jethro. And that also anticipates the pattern of Jesus at the well with the Samaritan woman. So everything is, in a sense, like a Wagnerian opera, that one leitmotif is echoing the leitmotifs that are going to be in other future times and past times. So you have to see the myth really like reading it on a musical score. There's the diachronic movement through time, but there's also the synchronic structure, so that all of these things are being lined up, and they should be seen in an imaginative space in which they're all one. And the only way that this can be is, of course, if you can think in patterns. Now, the dominant pattern of Genesis, of course, is the pattern of the fall. And this is exactly what you see recapitulated in the Joseph story. Now, the Joseph story is really amazing because it's in a world of Genesis, which had been stitched and sewn together by, say, the Yahwist, the redactor, the Elohist, and the priestly writer, suddenly there's this enormous story that just stands out, and it has all the qualities of a kind of novella. It's no wonder that Thomas Mann became obsessed with it and wrote a 4-volume novel of his own on it. But if you look at the Joseph story, it's very clear that what is being echoed here is, again, esoteric material, stuff that was in the Midrash but didn't make it into the Orthodox canon. When the coat of many colors is ripped from Joseph and he's dropped into the well, and you have the whole condition of the jealousy of the brothers, what you're getting in a recapitulation is the jealousy of the angels. The angels are our older brothers. And when they said, who is this baby Adam and why should we bow down before him? Then Joseph comes in and says, I had a dream and I saw all of you bowing before me. And they begin to revolt from him and say, why should we do this? And they tear his cloak away. And if you remember in the Midrash, when Eve eats the apple, the first thing that happens is her golden aura drops from her. So if you have visions of the human aura with all these bands of colors coming out of it, then you know what the coat of many colors is. And when you tear away the higher causal body and you drop the soul through time, then as it goes down through the dark well, it becomes merely the physical naked body. Remember last week when I read to you from the Gnostic text, where the soul as it fell, as it went down through layer of time, it took on a new body. So it has denser and denser bodies, the causal body, the astral body, the etheric body, and then finally the physical body. So the ripping away of the coat of many colors is ripping away the higher body before the fall. Dropping it into the well is dropping it into time. In a sense, it recalls the pattern of the fall in Egyptian mythology, where Set locks Osiris into the coffin and then flings him into the river. Here, rather than being flung into the river, one is being flung into the well. So again, what you have are patterns, and patterns that are recapitulating other ones. Now, it's interesting in terms of translations that the King James Bible has the coat of many colors, which is a kind of brilliant and informed translation. Other more scholarly types have said, no, that's not right. It should be embroidered robe or long sleeve robe. And then Voltaire says that we really can't translate it. We don't know what it means. It's quite mysterious. And so the whole thing gets tied up in a scholarly argument. But it's always interesting to see that when something goes through a modern translation, once again what you have is a loss of information, so that the esoteric is always dropped out. When you go from the King James Bible to say the eye is the light of the body, and if thine eye be single, then is thy whole body filled with light, that gets translated totally out of the esoteric dimension of yoga and meditation on the third eye, to saying the eye is the source of health, and if your eyes are healthy, your body is healthy. So it's very clear that no matter how brilliant the scholar was, he hadn't a clue that what was being described was an esoteric practice. And he hadn't a clue of what the actual experience of meditating on the third eye is like. In the same sense, in the King James Bible, which is obviously a great monument of the English language, by some hook or by crook, or some sort of vision out of the collective unconscious, that when they chose to say the coat of many colors, they created an archetypal pattern that connects with esoteric material, and obviously were sensitive to whole other dimensions of the myth. They had much more the mind of an artist that could see the way the jealousy of the brothers could relate to the jealousy of the angels, and the way the fall into the well related to the fall into time. Now, being stolen away into Egypt is actually the detour through history before man and God can be reconciled. So what you have in this incredibly great story of Joseph in Egypt is really a recapitulation and summing up of all the various themes that have gone on in Genesis. And so it's another way of turning on the spiral and looking at the whole problem of the fall. Joseph, in a sense, is the charismatic man. He's the elect. He's the chosen one. But he is chosen, and yet his gifts cause his fall. Because he is able to interpret dreams, and because he's a sensitive young man, he has this excellence that's going to raise him on high, but before that can happen, he has to be dropped into the well and lowered. So you have the sense that language is man's unique excellence, and yet language becomes the tragic flaw, and language creates the problem of the Tower of Babel. The interesting thing about Joseph is we again see this problem of the loss of information through time. Abraham can walk out with God and can construct a covenant. Isaac can see God, but Joseph can't. So by the time we are reaching the end of the patriarchal period and are moving in to the period of Egypt, we're moving into a situation where the contact with God is through divination or through mysticism or various kinds of dream interpretations, but it's no longer concrete, it's no longer prosaic, something has been lost. Now in the first dream, his first dream causes the brothers to throw him into the pit. Later the dreams save him. So you have this, again, this pattern that you see also in Homer, that what makes you great is your strength, but your strength is also your weakness. So your unique excellence is related to your tragic flaw. And yet it isn't something where you can just tear out your unique excellence and throw it away and become a whole person, because the same flaws are also what create and the same excellence are what create Joseph's redemption later on. His charm, in a sense, is what saves him and gets him to become the steward to Potiphar or Pharaoh, but his charm is what causes his downfall with Potiphar's wife. So he rises with Pharaoh, and then he begins to play with his family. And when the brothers come back from Canaan, and he begins to play this game with them of putting the chalice in the grain or putting their money back or saying, do you have an older father? Do you have a baby brother? He begins to go through this very stylized agon where he begins to play with him precisely in the way that Yahweh plays with man in time and in history. So in the same way that Yahweh plays with Abraham and the sacrifice of Isaac, now he begins to do this kind of dance. But in the dance, he's recapitulating all the patterns that have gone on before, and also consummately expressing the relationship between wildness and nomadism and the seasonal round and coming into civilization and trying to, in a sense, move out of the pattern of the nomadic life into the settled life in Egypt. So Joseph is the elect, he's the chosen one, and yet the consummate irony of the story is he is the one chosen to lead the people into Egypt. And when you turn the page in Genesis to Exodus, then you reach the whole sense that everything that had been blissful is now into tragedy, and there comes a Pharaoh who did not know Joseph, and suddenly they're in bondage and they're in slavery. So the whole notion, again, is that in the story, we're dealing with the world of opposites, not just the world of opposites of nomadism and civilization, but the whole opposites of tragedy and joy, and the way these things are linked together. So there, he is chosen and feels elevated and exalted and beloved of both Pharaoh and God, and yet he is the instrument to lead the Jews into 400 years of unending agony and suffering. So it's a great, in a sense, tragic paradox. And yet, out of Egypt, just as out of the well into which Joseph had fallen, Jacob's raggle-taggle band of pagan Hebrews, who are continually falling back into Canaanitic religion, just as Laban has his household gods and has them all about him in his home in Haran, you have the whole sense that the Jews are continually falling back into paganism and can't maintain the monotheism. So out of this kind of raggle-taggle band of gypsies emerges in the crucible of Egypt the whole monotheistic nation of Moses. So it's the introduction into Egypt is to forge, almost in the crucible of suffering, something that's going to be on a higher level because of the confrontation of civilization with savagery, or civilization with pastoralism, to be more precise. So first there was the confrontation of those opposites with Abraham leaving Ur, and then there is the confrontation as Joseph comes down into Egypt and brings the nomads into Egypt, and then out of that will be Moses, another nativistic leader, taking them out of civilization, but still with the message of civilization in them, in the way that Abraham had the message of Ur in him, out into the promised land. So once again you get patterns upon patterns upon patterns, and what you have in these patterns is that history becomes the performance of myth, that the figure-ground relationship between time and eternity is the figure-ground relationship between history and myth, and that always standing behind a historical event is the larger mythic archetype. So if we're seeing Joseph and the jealous brothers, we should remember the jealousy of the angels. And so if we're seeing one fall, we should remember the other fall. So events must satisfy a pattern in this form of history as a performance of myth. The Jews leaving Ur, or leaving Egypt, or leaving Babylon, or Nazi Germany, are always going out from a highly civilized and decadent society unto the land that I will show thee. So the pattern carries on from one end of the Magnus Annus to the other. The Jews, in a sense, as they're seen in this Magnus Annus of the Old Testament, are the chosen people. But the central irony of the book is that, like Joseph, they can't be proud because they don't know what they have been chosen for. And in the last analysis, the suggestion from the Joseph story is they have been chosen to be the catalytic agents of apocalypse. And why don't we end with apocalypse? So let's have tea. Apocalypse later. No clapping, tea. I'd like to explain some more things about Melchizedek that I didn't get to. I promise not to last another hour. It should only take about 5 minutes, maybe 10.
Wants to know about his eyes.
Is it pearls that wear his eyes? No, that comes from Dorothy. The Melchizedek Brotherhood is carried on in the scenes, I think, in something called the Q13 Melchizedek, which I think was found in the caves of Qumran. Melchizedek, up there. It's very, very much in with the Pista Sophia and the Gnostic texts, and it's taken up by the esoteric Muslims, the Sufis, and it figures very much in theosophy and contemporary groups. The fascinating thing, as I've said before, I guess last week, is how in many of the things that are going on today that are occult or esoteric, is that they're very much the same kinds of stuff that were in the Gnostics, and that a lot of it is incredibly ancient material, so that when you think you're dealing with new revelations, what you're getting, in a sense, is a tape from the collective unconscious that's really very, very ancient material. But as well, Melchizedek occurs in a lengthy description in Paul's letter to the Hebrews. And I wanted to read a little bit of that. In one place, he's talking about the esoteric, and he says, about Melchizedek, we have much to say, much that is difficult to explain, now that you've grown so dull of hearing. For indeed, though by this time you ought to be teachers, you need someone to teach you the ABCs of God's oracles over again. It has come to this that you need milk instead of solid food. Anyone who lives on milk, being an infant, does not know what is right. But grown men can take solid food. Their perceptions are trained by long use to discriminate between good and evil. And so he almost despairs of the possibility of dealing with such high matters as the order of Melchizedek. Then he goes on to say, this Melchizedek, king of Salem, priest of God Most High, met Abraham returning from the route of the kings and blessed him. And Abraham gave him a tithe of everything as his portion. His name in the first place means king of righteousness. Next he is king of Salem, that is king of peace. He has no father, no mother, no lineage. His years have no beginning, his life no end. He is like the Son of God. He remains a priest for all time. Consider now how great he must be for Abraham the patriarch to give him a tithe of the finest of the spoil. The descendants of Levi who take their priestly office are commanded by the law to tithe the people. Now this is the priesthood of the sons of Levi coming from Aaron. But Melchizedek, though he does not trace his descent from them, has tithed Abraham himself and given his blessing to the man who received the promises. And beyond all dispute, the lesser is always blessed by the greater. Again, in one instance, tithes are received by men who must die, but in the other by one whom Scripture affirms to be alive. It might even be said that Levi, who receives tithes, has himself been tithed through Abraham, for he was still in his ancestor's loins when Melchizedek met him. Now, if perfection had been attainable through the Levitical priesthood, and here's this problem again, how do you hold values through time? Can you create a city which has a temple, which has a priesthood that derives by institutional authority and a canonical study of the Torah and things of this sort? Can you derive from, say, Aaron and the sons of Levi a valid institutional religion? Now, if perfection had been attained through the Levitical priesthood, for it is on this basis that the people were given the law, what further need would there have been to speak of another priest arising in the succession of Melchizedek instead of the succession of Aaron? For a change of priesthood must mean a change of law. And the one here spoken of belongs to a different tribe, no member of which has ever been sprung to do with the altar. For it is very evident that our Lord is sprung from Judah, a tribe to which Moses made no reference in speaking of priests. The argument becomes still clearer. If the new priest who arises is one like Melchizedek, owing his priesthood not to a system of earthbound rules, but to the power of a life that cannot be destroyed, for here is the testimony, quote, and then he quotes a psalm. There are only really three places in the Bible, meaning the Old and New Testaments, where Melchizedek is mentioned. This letter to the Hebrews, the psalm, and then Genesis. Quote, thou art a priest forever in the succession of Melchizedek. The earlier rules are canceled as impotent and useless, since the law brought nothing to perfection, and a better hope is introduced through which we can draw near to God. So what you're getting then here, again, is this sense of distinction of opposites. You have Moses coming out and creating a new system of duality. Moses speaks to God, and then Aaron speaks to Moses, and then Aaron goes to speak to Pharaoh and becomes his lips. So you have the whole, in a sense, split in the routinization of charisma, whereby certain energies can't translate in one person and you have to have a spokesman. Aaron then begins to be the institutional man, the spokesman, the go-between. And out of Aaron derives the whole sons of Levi, who are the priests and who are in the temple and who collect the dues and organize and run the church and run the society or run the temple. And there the whole idea of, can you have values in form? The other one is outside of time, and so you have the order of Melchizedek, but in Christian succession of this, you get the two churches or the two orders of Melchizedek and the sons of Levi recapitulating it in the Church of John, which has a lot of Gnostic material, and the Church of Peter. So in historical times, from Lindisfarne, the first Lindisfarne, when there was the confrontation between the imperial church, which was coming out of cities, Rome, which was organized according to urban structures, basically a bishop in every city, it confronted the pastoral church, which was the Celtic church. There were no cities in Ireland or Scotland, therefore there were no bishops. Therefore, the priest or head of Lindisfarne or Iona was a common man. The abbot was not, until much later, made into a bishop. So you have this whole pattern that the Celts said when they confronted the English church coming up from Augustine and coming from Rome, that they said, we were here before you arrived. We are the church of John, not the church of Peter. And the Roman church said, who cares what's going on in an insignificant little corner of the world? Rome is what's important. And there was a main confrontation between the two. Once again, it was the pastoral versus urban confrontation. And the urban one won because Rome succeeded. The Synod of Whitby put down the Celtic church. They were integrated with the calendar. Again, the calendar is very much the whole way of how do you measure time. They had to abandon the Celtic calendar and take on the Roman calendar. Now, in John, there are a lot of esoteric and Gnostic materials, especially in some things that are not accepted by the Catholic Church or the Orthodox Christians, like the Acts of John, the Apocryphon of John. In Jesus' round dance and crucifixion, Jesus comes to John and says, they see me being crucified, but you know that something else is going on, and at the end of the cycle, you will now become what I am. And so Jesus is more or less saying, at the end of the Magnus Annus, you will be raised to the level of Christic initiation. So you have this whole sense that Peter is the rock upon which the church is formed, and he is the institutional form, the attempt to hold values in time, the papacy and all of that, and he is the direct lineal descendant of the sons of Levi in the temple. John is the prophet at the outside of time, and in one of the medieval hymns it says, for John leaned upon the breast of Jesus at the Last Supper and was made initiate to all the mysteries of the universe. So John is the beloved disciple who knows things that Peter doesn't know. And John is the figure of authority to which the Celtic church at Iona and Lindisfarne referred themselves to and derived there from the Melchizedek. So that this line of succession is not a lineal descent, has no priesthood, has no authority, and speaks totally in a different sort of way. Now, the way you get this in contemporary Christian theology is, say, in David Spanger's book, because David will go into meditation and receive transmissions from a being called John of the order of Melchizedek. And so David has a relationship to a priest of the Melchizedek order in the same way that Ibn Arabi had his initiation by a trans human being or bodhisattva or whatever you want to call it. So the order of Melchizedek, again, is always stressing that it has to be ahistorical, has to be outside of time, has to be a strategy rather than an institution. And so this is the archetypal pattern for things like Lindisfarne 1 or Lindisfarne 2. Now, the difficulty that this gets into, as things break into opposites, it isn't simply the case that John is true and Peter is false. This is a recapitulation of the earlier Egyptian pattern of Set and Osiris. According to the Theosophist, there are two orders that are extra-human or extraterrestrial, whatever you want to call them. There's the order of Melchizedek, and there's the order of Lucifer. One, the Luciferian Brotherhood is the creator of the temple, the creator of form, the creator of limitation. Lucifer creates, the bringer of light, and creates, in a sense, consciousness and the body and the knowledge of good and evil, and is the form by which all things are embodied and limited and structured. So the first kind of temple or prison that he creates is the body, like Set creating the coffin for Osiris. The second form is the temple. And so whether you're dealing with the temple and the sons of Levi, or you're dealing with the temple and the papacy and the Inquisition and things of this sort, you're dealing with the institutionalization of truth, the incarceration of truth, the systemization of truth, the attempt to hold values against the flow of time rigidly in a way that becomes dead, and the letter of the law rather than the spirit. But in all the mythologies, you always have two brothers, or two disciples, or two gods, Set and Osiris, Melchizedek or Moses and Aaron, and Melchizedek and Abraham. And in the ways that this recapitulates itself into Christianity, Peter becomes the Luciferian priesthood, the creator of the temple, the creator of the church, the creator of the papacy, the rock, the obdurate, ordinary, common man. And John becomes the mystical initiate to the side of time, who is there and is mysterious and is hardly understood. And the Church of John never really creates an institutional form. It's always simply a brotherhood or association, and has its associations in Gnosticism. Now, in the collision between the heretics, in the rejection of the Gnostics, most of the stuff that we know about the Gnostics, in a sense, are written by the Church Fathers quoting them to show that they're wrong. What I think goes on in this, and I don't know any metaphor for this in nature, and maybe some of you can show me how it might work, is I think there's a kind of refraction or bending or splitting, that when light comes down from a higher dimension of consciousness beyond duality, let's say from pure being, pure light, ontos, and goes into the brute-resisting medium of matter or time-space, it splits. And it splits into opposites that are simultaneously true and false, so that if you identify the shaded area as distortion, as the message hits the resisting medium of space-time, it splits and twists and turns and becomes what we would call deception or distortion or falsehood. And another part of it remains pure and true. The distribution of truth and falsehood is not simply in one camp, so that we don't get the Gnostics getting the true message and the Orthodox Christians getting the false one. We get a situation where it's simultaneously half and half, and that there are certain aspects in Gnosticism that are clearly off the wall and that are really heretical, and why the Church Fathers were fighting it so vigorously. There are other aspects of Orthodoxy that are clearly stupid and resistant and dumb and exoteric and just simply don't know what's going on from an esoteric point of view. A good example of that is that when I was talking about, for the eye is the light of the body. The clod who is the translator has never meditated a day in his life, and he doesn't know what he's talking about. So you get this whole aspect of the shift, and part of the nature of the fall, which is a description of the limitations of space-time, is that we want to align the dial so we get all the good guys in one camp and all the bad guys in the other camp, but it's always the case in any war or any conflict or any battle that the good guys and the bad guys are on one side and the good guys and bad guys are on the other side, and there's no way you can shift the dial of space-time to get everybody in one place in space-time, short of the redemption of the fall and moving into another world. So there's a kind of crystalline quality by which this breaks apart, and the Gnostics and Orthodox have been arguing for thousands of years, and now in the resurrection of esoteric material in people like Rudolf Steiner or David Spangler, you're getting a return of the order of Melchizedek, because in a sense we are at the end of the Christian 2,000-year cycle. We are now in the end of the age of chaos, and we're beginning a new age of gods, and so we have the return of the order of Melchizedek into history, and so you get people like David Spangler communicating directly and getting transmissions and things of that sort. Some are in his book, some are so esoteric they're not even in his book. So at any rate, that again runs into the thing that St. Paul is saying, that, you know, we've become so dumb that we should be able to take meat or real food, but we have to be given milk and pablum and things of that sort. So this, I think what I'm trying to say in a sense is that the fall is a map of consciousness. History is the projection of that map of consciousness into time, and that what the map is about is the inherent contradictions of space-time and the way consciousness is possible in space-time. But the myth is affirming that consciousness is not only space-time, that there is consciousness that extends forever and that is not limited, so that we have to, in a sense, not identify with our bodies or our egos or our institutions or our cultures or our historical moment, that there is always something that is outside that skewed sample of events. Anyway, I'll end there and give you a chance to have at me or ask questions or whatever. Does that make sense? Okay, what are the no parts? Yes and no, right. It comes out splitting into opposites.
It's aesthetically
impediment. Aesthetic what?
Aesthetically
impediment. Is there can you think of anything in nature that would do that? Is there a kind of crystal by which things would, when hitting, split like that, like a mirror image or something?
Thermal refraction crystals, and that's indigo.
Yeah, I'd like to see something in nature that I could say, you know, because I don't know what I'm talking about. Oops, sorry. But anyway, there was an esoteric school at Chartres that Chris knows more about. And there was an, what was the esoteric master, the Lille, or I've forgotten his name. But it's very clear that in the architecture and the proportions, Keith Critchlow will be coming from the research into Lost Knowledge Group, and we'll probably have some other people lecturing on the esoteric geometry and significance of Chartres. But beyond the mathematics and the proportions and the kind of music associated with the school, the sculpture itself really, I think, reveals that they know all this stuff, and that it's even though it's suppressed by the Orthodox Church, that they have are passing it on in some kind of mystery guild from teacher to disciple. I need a chair. Right. Any questions or arguments or disagreements or whatever? Tom.
What your diagram, what it reminds me of is the way light breaks up in a prism, the white light coming in and then breaking into the
ultraviolet spectrum.
To the visible spectrum. So what you have are the three primary colors, red, yellow, and blue, which the red and the blue would be the opposite colors. You'd have the two poles, like the red would be the coming down on the positive masculine solar side, which would correspond with the Orthodox, which was John Michel said in his interpretation of Revelation, of Book of Revelation, was that was the beast of the solar logos of 666 was the church, the Church of Peter. And then the Gnostics would come down on the blue side, which would be the other pole of more the feminine, more sonic.
Interestingly enough, the order Melchizedek uses as its colors ultraviolet.
And then what is lost then in the play of opposites is the yellow, the mutable color in the middle of the spectrum, which is kind of in between or beyond the play of opposites, and it's alchemical gold, the color of the sun and everything,
mm-hmm.
which is lost in that.
Hmm. Yes. Right.
What do you know about him, and does he fit into that?
Saint Germain is one of the one of these disincarnate beings that I was describing from Henri Corbin's book, and is one of the members of the Order of Melchizedek. Yeah, there are various others going by various other names.
Where does he start in point of history, or myth, or which is it?
Well, as a historical figure, under that lineage, he relates to Rosicrucians and Freemasonry and to alchemy and to the Comte de Saint-Germain. But
he was fairly recent that way, wasn't he? French, kind of 17th century or something?
Well, according to the Findhorn groups, he's also in various incarnations as Lord Bacon, and that Saint-Germain only identifies one aspect of his being, and that he's a much more complex bodhisattva than just that particular historical role. And he's identified as the lord of civilization, concerned with power and the all esoteric and exoteric aspects of power and governance and order and culture, as opposed to others like Kutumi, who is supposed to be the sage Pythagoras, who's more the teacher. They're supposed to be masters for rays, and rays are supposed to be various bands of these colors, and the rays have to do with the spectrum of consciousness and various qualities of consciousness, from love to will and power to knowledge and things of this sort.
Is that
all right? Well, it's some of it's in Alice Bailey and the Theosophists, and in Annie Besant, and what's the other woman?
Blavatsky.
So it's in that, which is a kind of 19th century syncretic movement that's trying to translate some of the concepts in language from Sanskrit into English, so that the various bodies in Sanskrit get translated as causal body, astral body, etheric body, things of that sort. But Findhorn's very much involved with all of that stuff. Yeah. Is that where you first ran across St. Germain? Was it Findhorn?
I ran across it in Honolulu. There's a group called the Bridge to Freedom. And they were kind of an offshoot, apparently, of Theosophy, I gather. And they had, there was one man who had started it in Honolulu, and he had large, well, they almost looked like tinted photographs of St. Germain. I got the impression that, you know, he had started maybe even later. I don't know when.
The interesting thing about the quality of a message going through a resisting medium and picking up distortion and noise is that in the Hazrat Inayat Khan talks about the astral plane is really going to disappear when the race is initiated to a higher level, and that the astral plane is really like the collective unconscious, to use Jung's phrase, and it's really the mind of the race in dream. And so there are all these forms that sometimes people or mediums will pick up and will give much more credence to and say, I've received a transmission from St. Germain. There's a group called the Summit Lighthouse that runs a university called of Ascended Masters University. And it's full of these kind of archetypal astral plane thought forms, which they believe with great devoutness that are absolutely true and real, but they're all kind of very Old Testament of, you know, the apocalypse is coming and you're all going to get fried and, you know, you got to get on our side. And they sell canned goods to store in your cellar and to be ready and stuff like that. And
came out of the Great I Am.
That's right, from Ballard in Mount Shasta.
And
yeah.
Their headquarters are on the North Shore here. Their world headquarters. And they have a July thing from all over the world.
Really?
That happens.
I've been to Mount Shasta, but no one was there when I was there, but I saw some of the places of the Church I Am movement. But I think it's another one of these examples, like the Book of Urantia, that is information plus a lot of noise, that when people basically go into automatic writing, they're just plugging into the mind of the race dreaming, and they just come up with all kinds of stuff, and they can sit there forever with various kinds of chimeras. It's what Yeats calls the den of the sleepers. Don't go in there, for there is a people of dreams. And it's the path of the chameleon. It just keeps changing and changing. So it's always cautioned against in all esoteric schools not to pay a lot of attention to all that mystical mumbo-jumbo. And in the Zen terms, you just say it's high-class macchio. And it's not, you know, not really... Right, yeah. But sometimes groups use exactly the same terms, like Saint Germain occurs in Findhorn and occurs in the United States, and they're almost like, you know, opposites. That the whole, it's funny how something can be said and the vibe in one place can be okay and then another place just totally off the wall. And so it's a peculiarity about how do you have information and how do you pass on information through time, and how can a vision become an institution without distortion? And it seems to be a basic problem.
In this resonance, the evolutionary resonance of myth, is there a connection between Lilith and the women in cities? I know that Rachel and Sarah are the only ones that can make it in cities. Abraham can't make it in the city. They have to live off the women. There's always been some doubt in my mind about who actually were the fathers of Isaac, whether Rachel actually had relations with the men from Sodom and Gomorrah. This Sodom and Gomorrah scene is nuttier than a fruitcake.
Yeah, right, right.
So I was just wondering if the women are connected with cities all the way through and the evil therein.
Well, there is a relationship between, I think, cities and the feminine, and I think probably you're right that the archetypal pattern behind that is Lilith, who dwells in ruins. One of the reasons that Abraham has to send back to Haran to his brothers to get the wives is that all the tribes around him are matrilocal. And so if his sons were to marry, they would have to go away from the faith of the fathers and live with the mothers. And so he's from a tradition that is patrilocal. And so the way he avoids it is really by endogamy. He continually marries off his children to his close relatives and to their cousins, in a sense. So he has to send always back to Haran and to find them and then bring them down from Haran into Ur. And this always brings, in a sense, an introduction of a tricky principle. But the life that they seem to be living, say like Laban, is a life, is an interface. It's a life at the edge of cities. It's dealing with the traders who are moving through the seasonal round and dealing with making bucks off the people who live in cities, but not yet being in cities. So it's like a little city, like a shtetl. And so it probably the pattern for the shtetls of Odessa in Central Europe may have this biblical formation, the Jews as traders and people who mediate between one culture and another. But they don't seem themselves to be the archetypal builders of cities. So there's, again, where the flirtation with the opposite comes in, but they're not actually the Sumerians or whomever. Mm-hmm. David?
Let's move a little bit more on the order of Melchizedek. Does it have any historical or temporal place? I mean, is it strictly like an esoteric idea?
Oh, well, according to, say, people like David Spangler, yeah, Shambhala. And so it converts with
the... Of it?
Yeah, it's very similar to Tibetan Buddhist notions of Shambhala. Nechung Rinpoche was here last year and talking about the prophecies of Shambhala and the edge of chaos. And again, he was talking about these opposites, saying that Shambhala is this higher realm of the gods. And according to the Tibetan prophecies, which they shared with the Hopis here last summer, there will be thermonuclear war, and this will change the etheric structure of the planet and help materialize and make Shambhala manifest in space-time, which is another way of running the myth through and saying that out of the age of chaos, the fertile decay will come, by which the new age of gods will come, and the new age of gods will be manifest and profane. The sacred will become ordinary again. And so the gods will live and dwell with us. So Shambhala is the seat of the order of Melchizedek on the earth. And it's mentioned in the Alice Bailey stuff and by David and other people who are Gnostics in the 20th century. I don't know if Steiner mentions it or not, I don't remember.
Where in history does it manifest? You mentioned
the
Celtic Church, for example.
The part of it is supposed to be leading them, the tribes, out of Shambhala down into India in the laws of Manu and the Aryan invasion and things of that sort. So that's supposed to be an initiation from Shambhala in the prehistoric period, beginning the Age of Gods, at around 4,000. But the other touches with history are always quite slight. So there are things like Melchizedek coming in and then just disappearing, or they're like the Church of John. And John is very chimerical in terms of Orthodox Christianity, and very little is known about him. And yet the Celtic Church keeps calling themselves the Church of John, and they seem to be privy to more esoteric traditions than the other, the Roman Church. But when they lose, then those things disappear, and the esoteric tradition doesn't survive. Part of the reason the esoteric tradition doesn't survive is, of course, just simply because of they're killed any time they start being heretics. So whether you've got the Albigensian Crusade, where they're just wiped out, or you've got the Inquisition, or you've got the witch hunts by the Protestants, you have a kind of conscious attempt to root out heresy and to burn them at the stake, which of course reinforces the pattern that the esoteric people become more tight-lipped and get all caught up in the glamours of secret societies and oaths and like little boys' clubs of, you know, locking the door and saying, you know, sign in blood and only us and all this kind of stuff, which is very big in Freemasonry and the Rosicrucians and the rest of it. Now we seem to be in one of those periods where all the mystical societies are opening their doors wide and all the esoteric material is just pouring out, whether it's coming from the Sufis or the Tibetans or whatever tradition. It's all in paperback book and available at Wise's.